rain, so it's not so glaring, is it?
Never mind.
No.
Mrs. Scott, what can you remember of the university when you were a small girl and the university was very new?
Well, the university wasn't very new. It had been a school. It had been a boys' school for some years, I think.
Mm.
And father was made assistant, first of all, at the university. He was an assistant, first of all, for 2 years, and then he was made the registrar and carried on as that and loved it. He was very keen about languages, so I don't know how many he didn't know. And he loved the meeting the young people. He was a great help to them.
Mm. You actually lived in the university building?
There were three stories. The bottom one, we had our kitchen, and that went round. The father's office was there, and the students' room, students' common room, was on that floor.
I wonder if I could show you this photograph of the old university building.
Yes.
Now, there are the three stories that you were telling
us
about.
Yes, the three stories.
The students' common room was whereabouts?
Looking out that way, the other way, towards the back.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and father's office was
Your father's office was on the ground floor?
On the ground floor, yes. There were cellars underneath.
Whereabouts did you live when you were a little girl?
We were on the first floor. First floor.
And your own bedroom was where?
At the very top. All the bedrooms were at the top.
So your bedroom was up there?
And my bedroom was a little room off my father and mother's room. And beyond that, there were the boys' room. And that opened onto the landing. You know, the two buildings were divided by a lovely staircase with beautiful banisters to slide down.
Did you slide down them when you were a little girl?
Yes.
You did?
Yes, we did when we were not caught.
And, of course, this hedge in front of the university has memories for you. What did you do on that hedge?
Used to run along the top because it was nice and firm. It was beautifully thick. And they had a good gardener who kept clipped. But we were not, of course, were not supposed to run along.
How old were you when you lived in the university building on the Domain?
11.
Yes.
From 11 to 13, 2 years. And the classrooms were on the second floor.
Yes.
And there was a lovely long, which is afterwards the library, on that floor. And I can remember that they had an entertainment there, and I can remember being allowed to peep over the banisters to see the lovely ladies arrive in their clothes.
Well, here is another photograph of the university in the old days, and I think that's your father
yes,
at the door.
That's father at the door. Yes.
And these young ladies are wearing academic dress of the day.
Academic dresses.
Did all the students wear academic dress then?
Yes, yes, all had to. They had to wear them, as far as I know, as far as I remember.
This, of course, looks like the library, this room. Is that the room where the entertainment was?
That would be the room, yes, on the second floor up, where most of the classrooms were.
What about the students in those days? I suppose it was a very difficult business to get into the university then.
I don't know at all about the students. See, we didn't have any contact with them.
Did you see them?
And we would see them come, and we knew that they were there in the classrooms, because if we played round the front, the window would go up, go away, there's a class.
Were there many women among the early students at the university?
Mostly men, mostly boys, yes. But I don't really remember them.
But you do remember some of the members of the faculty. I think you remember Professor Flynn.
Professor Flynn, yes. I remember him. And his wife was a lovely woman.
And
beautiful.
His son was Errol Flynn, of
course. His son was Errol Flynn, yes.
What was the limerick about Professor Flynn?
Professor Flynn, sir, tall and thin, sir, lectured in biology, tortured dogs, sir, pickled frogs, sir, sent them all with eau de vie. That was at Commem, after the students used to sing these about the professors. Professor Williams was of a different type, and I can only remember Professor Bill, sir, makes us ill, sir. That's all. He was on the other side of the university.
And his family lived there at the same time as you did?
His family lived there. And his boys had the top room and used to meet our boys on the landing at the top and have pillow fights. Had great fun there.
I suppose, with your father being the registrar and you knowing the professors and the staff by sight, you would have got the feeling that the university was a very friendly place in those days.
Well, no, because we were kept away. Mm. We were too naughty, really, I suppose. We were regarded as a nuisance, I think.
Well, from your recollections of the university, yes, did you get the impression that it was like a kind of special school?
Yes, it was more like a school for us than that. And we used to go to school from there, of course.
Your school was at Anglesey Barracks?
Yes, was up there, the girls' high school.
Mm. What about other women? I think this photograph is of your great friend, Sarah Dunbabin.
That was of her.
What can you tell me about Sarah Dunbabin? She was one of the early women graduates, I think.
She was. She was very good at languages. And she could write. During the war, she wrote to the different, mostly to the Poles. And she got letters from them right up to the time of her death, or just before her death.
She was one of the early masters of arts, yes, among women.
Yes, among women. She didn't take much life in the university. She was too retiring, really.
She was a shy girl.
Too shy, very shy girl.
But clever.
Very clever. Oh, brilliant. It's a very brilliant family, because her cousin being a professor.
Old Professor Dunbabin.
Professor Dunbabin, yes. And her brother was editor of the newspapers in Canada towards his death, and over the other side too in Melbourne. He was a Rhodes Scholar, very clever too.
Coming back to the university, The students all used to wear academic dress all the time. You would see them arrive wearing their gowns in the mornings?
No, they'd have to change them.
Change at the university?
Yes, at the university.
Uh-huh. Here is a photograph of, we presume, some members of the university faculty early in the century. Can you recognise any of them? We think that's your father there.
Father there, yes. And Mr. Kingsmill.
Do you know what Mr. Kingsmill lectured in?
He was my brother-in-law, married my sister.
Yes.
Yes.
What did he do in the university?
He was, I don't really know what he was doing there, but he was very clever.
And these are presumably some of the lady undergraduates again.
Some of the lady undergraduates, yes.
There is another photograph of university staff.
And I can only
in the early days.
I can only recognise this one, the centre one.
There.
And I think
sitting
it
down
was Professor McDougall.
Professor McDougall?
Yes, of law.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not sure of that.
You don't have a limerick about him?
No.
What a pity.
No, I'm sorry.
Looking back, do you have any idea of the kind of impact that the establishment of the university had on Hobart? I mean, when you were older and living in Hobart and people discovered that your father had been the original registrar, did people say anything about the importance of the university's establishment to Hobart?
Well, I'm afraid I can't remember that. I can't remember. I'm afraid I'm not clever enough.
I think you're selling yourself short. Mrs. Scott, let's talk about you for a moment. You came to live here in about 1902 or 3. 1903. And you were still going to school in Hobart then?
Used to walk down to the train, down the muddy road, which was called the Dusty Miller Road in those days.
It was about 3/4 of a mile, isn't it?
And just a mile down to the train and then into Macquarie Street. And then we walked another mile up to the barracks.
And you did that morning and afternoon?
Yes.
All through your school career?
All through, yes. For 4 miles a day, which gave me good walking. Yeah.
Was it a good school?
Very good school. We loved our school. We loved our teachers. They were wonderful. Miss Clarks.
Did you want to go on to university?
I was not clever enough. I did try just for the first year when I left school, but it was right beyond me, and I was glad then to take on kindergarten teaching.
And so you were a kindergarten teacher?
So I was a kindergarten after.
Let's talk about what people did in their spare time in the early 1900s. Now, living here in Glenorchy, what did you do with your spare time? Did you ride horses or what?
I had a horse and used to ride around all up and down the country roads, and we used to go for picnics in the dray. We'd have an old cart horse and we'd spend most of our time outside.
You told me earlier that you've climbed just about every mountain and hillside around here. Was that a great diversion for people in Hobart in the old days?
Quite a number used to do that. Yes, we'd meet parties of people.
Climbing. All the tracks up on Mount Wellington?
Yes, all the tracks. And they had lovely little huts they made. I think they've gone now. But they were beautiful huts there by the Cascades. And people made tracks through. They were keen about exploring, because it was all fairly new, wasn't it?
And of course you had to make your own entertainment, didn't you?
Yes, we made our own entertainments. We used to, if we went in, I can remember when I was 17 going to my first film, we had to go in by dray to Moona, leave the horse and go by tram, double-decker tram, into the theatre.
Can you remember which theatre it was?
Oh, the one that's still there, the Royal Hobart.
Oh, the Theatre Royal?
The Theatre Royal, that's what its name is, yes. Yes, that was the only one then.
Magic Lantern Show, was it?
No. Oh, no.
Moving Picture.
The Moving Pictures then. I think they'd only just come on, really.
Have you any idea what year that was?
Well, when I was 17, you worked that out.
Well, that would be about 1904 or 5.
Yes. Be about then.
What do you think yourself, looking back on all the years, and knowing Sarah Dunbabin and presumably other graduates, what impact do you think university has had over the years on Tasmania and Hobart? Do you think it's enriched the life of the city?
Oh, it has. Oh, it has enriched them, because they have wanted to continue. They have had...
We've been lucky with the staff we've been able to attract over the years.
But I didn't take part, so that I don't know really much about that part. I lived fairly quietly and never had much money.
But your time as a little girl living in the university was happy?
Well, we were very glad to get away from it.
Were you?
Because I can remember we moved first to Newtown, and my brother and I shouting at the top of our voices because we had had to be so quiet in the university. We didn't, you know, if we made a noise at all, there would be a bang on the door. There's a class going.
Very difficult for children of 10.
Yes, so. It's children. I'm afraid we were glad to get away and into the freedom.
Mrs. Scott, thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It was lovely. And having brothers too, see, we always played, you know, out of doors.
Good.
Tape identification. This is an interview with the Emeritus Professor W.A. Townsley, former Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at the University of Tasmania, recorded in the studio at the Clinical School of the University of Tasmania on Monday the 4th of December 1978. Interviewer, John Roberts. Professor Townsley, your path to the chair of political science was rather different from that of most people who begin as lecturers or tutors and then move through the ranks and from university to university. You came to the university straight from the army in 1945. What was the university like in those days?
Well, John, it was an extremely small show, of course. I had the advantage of seeing a number of the older professors who were there. Some were fortunately still alive, but some had associations with the university going back right to the 1890s.
Who were they?
For instance, I was thinking of particularly Professor Dunbabin. We used to sit together munching sandwiches in a very tiny staff room up at the Domain. That's where the university was then. And he used to reminisce most beautifully about what it was like when he first went up to Oxford in the 1890s, and he described how Gladstone came up in 1894 on his last visit, and what the students thought of Gladstone and so forth. And I felt this was a link, a traditional link between the old world universities of Europe and our little university on the Domain in Hobart. Then there was Dr. Morris Miller. He was at that time just retiring as part-time vice-chancellor, but don't forget he was professor of philosophy, professor of psychology, librarian, and acting vice-chancellor. Give you some idea of what a small show it was. And Morris Miller had varied experience. He used to tell me stories about campaigning in England with the Liberals in the early part of the century, and some terrifically rowdy scenes with the suffragettes when he was campaigning with Churchill or Asquith. So these were interesting links with the past, which I've always valued. Now, coming back to your point about the university itself, it was, of course, a very small shop.
Was it, in fact, a glorified high school, as some people suggested?
I wouldn't like to call it that. I think it always had a reputation of a university, even if it was very small. It was very, very poor, because it was dependent upon state funds. And there was a time in the Depression of the 30s when the Legislative Council passed a motion to abolish it. I don't know if that's been recorded, but it's quite definitely on the books. It survived those times, and it had a number of very distinguished scholars, despite the fact the staff was small. And some, of course, were notoriously eccentric, like Professor Flynn, the father of the well-known film actor. But when I first came, there were a number who had been there from the 1920s, like Alan Byrne and Professor Pittman, Professor Mathematics, Professor Taylor, and they were all distinguished men in their own right. So I wouldn't call it a glorified high school. It was just a small state and very poor university.
What happened to it in the years after the Second World War? Was its character changing, or was it changed dramatically?
Well, yes, there was a dramatic change at once, and for this reason, that as elsewhere, the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme applied into Tasmania, And that was the reason I first came in. I didn't come in as a lecturer. I came in appointed by Dr. Boris Miller under the Commonwealth Training Scheme, working with the Commonwealth Government in the mornings and with the Universities Commission of the University in the afternoon to bring in ex-servicemen who were training. And they were great days. I know so many doctors and lawyers and teachers in this town and this state who came through my hands in 1945 and early 1946. Now these men, between 46 and 49, really transformed the nature of the university.
In what way?
Not only increased the numbers, but they brought a seriousness into the university. After all, some of them had been away 5 and 6 years, and they had time to make up, and they weren't at the university just to play around. And they set a good standard. And I think that was the big turning point so far as the student population of the university was concerned. And of course it had a big impact on the staff. With more students, we got new staff, and there was obvious demand for a raising of the standards to bring it into line with the standards of the universities on the mainland.
Would you regard those years then from 46 to 49 as a time of dramatic change for the university, or simply a speeding up of a process which was happening anyway?
No, I would go so far as to say it was a decisive change. I think it was a much more leisurely university up to that time. A smaller number of people used to come. They were, on the whole, restricted to teachers in training, and they came through the college, which stood next door, and the sons and daughters of the better-to-do who were going into the professions like law or medicine. But from that time on, there was an increase in numbers and a growing seriousness.
What about those painful years then in the mid-50s when the Orr case and the associated cases, the Royal Commission and so on, dragged on? What effect did that have on this university which had already changed in the period after 46?
Well, after the 46, 1949-50 development, there were, of course, great expectations. And when you get great expectations that are not fulfilled, there's usually trouble. And this is exactly what happened in the University of Tasmania.
What were the expectations?
Well, I think with the new staff who had come in to teach and do research, they expected the new university, which had already been announced, be built at Sandy Bay, would come more quickly. They expected the state government to respond in terms of salaries and general conditions to make the university equivalent to that of Melbourne, Sydney, and the other universities of the mainland. Now, this didn't happen. To some extent, therefore, the state government was to blame. On the other hand, in fairness to it, one must remember the state government was faced with a lot of work, backlog of work, particularly housing, to catch up after 6 years of war. And they did give priority to other forms of construction rather than the university. So with all these frustrations, by about 1953, the staff was in a state of discontent and ferment. And as often happens, the people who catch it when troubles are not always the ones to blame. I'm thinking particularly of the Chancellor, Sir John Morris, known to most of his friends as Jack Morris. Now, no man gave more in the way of cultural development to this state, certainly up to that time, than Jack Morris. Not only did he develop the state library, not only did he get the Adult Education Board established, but he fought like hell to get university staff and develop the university. Now, he was perhaps a bit high-handed and sometimes a little unfortunate in his phrasing as Chancellor of the Council of the University. And he had to take the brunt of the attack once the staff blew up.
It has been suggested that up to the time of war in the mid-50s, that it was a very paternalistic relationship between the university body, the faculty, and the University Council, that the Council was composed of a lot of people who had old-fashioned ideas about the role of the university in the society, and that there was a degree of paternalism which didn't wash anymore.
Well, there may have been some paternalism, but certainly was paternalism with regard to the Chancellor, whom I've just mentioned. A lot of the other members of council I knew personally, and I would not have regarded them as paternalistic. They were well-known members of this community, and I think that the blow-up by the staff which led to the Royal Commission took them utterly by surprise.
Do you think the blow-up was inevitable?
Well, in retrospect, I think so, yes, because the staff frustrations had got to the point that something had got to break. I supported the Staff Association right up to a certain point when I disagreed with some of the procedures, some of the methods being used to push it. And it was from this Royal Commission days, quite apart from Professor Orr, that the divisions within the university began to appear. I mean, among the staff. Mm. It even divided departments, unhappily. And the Orr case that came on top of that simply accentuated the troubles that had come through the lead-up to the Royal Commission and the bitter things that were said during the Royal Commission. Now, I remember Roy Fagan in the House of Assembly arguing against the Royal Commission, and he said, a Royal Commission will create bitterness which won't be forgotten for 10 or 20 years. How true he was. That's just how it happened, most unfortunately. Now, I'm not saying that there wasn't room for reform. Definitely there was. And I think one thing that came out of the Royal Commission report was a restructuring of the university and a better relationship between the academic body, the professorial board, and the council.
From your point of view, if it hadn't been Orr, would it have been somebody else who sparked off the whole change and turmoil of the mid-50s?
That's a very difficult one to answer. I've already said that there were plenty of causes there laying to be set alight, you know. There's plenty of stuff there to be set alight. But Orr was a catalyst. Mm. He was an extraordinary man, and he certainly took certain leads which precipitated the trouble. But once it started, a lot of the people who wanted the Royal Commission wanted to keep him out of it, because he was a difficult man to control.
So I suppose one could say from what you've just said then that Orr was almost incidental to the whole thing, that something was going to happen anyway.
Yes, that would be my view. It's quite wrong to say that Orr caused the Royal Commission. There were many people involved, and very serious ones, like Professor Carey, who was the chairman of the professorial board, and very distinguished professors like Professor Pittman came into the Staff Association. And they got a little alarmed, as I did, when Orr tried to turn it in certain directions. But it would be only fair to say that he was the spark. I didn't mean that as a... his name was Spark, but you know, I didn't mean to...
No pun intended. 24 years on, 1978.
Yes.
Is the university better as a result of all that?
Oh, I'm sure. I think it certainly suffered for a long time. Though we had the agonizing experience of 10 years, because, you see, the Orr case, which I've... I want to emphasize, it was a separate thing from the Royal Commission, and it was a personal, a very tragic affair, very tragic for all concerned, for the professor, for the girl student, for Mrs. Orr, for everybody involved, very tragic indeed. But from then, when that broke in end of 55, until 64, when assessment was made to Professor Orr, the university still suffered from the bitternesses of those years. Some stuff of these divisions within the staff, and it was only the coming of new staff who had nothing to do with it that with time there was a healing process. But in answer to your question, we went through all the tribulations, the traumas of the 50s, but it did bring out a better university, unquestionably.
You have no doubt of that?
No doubt at all. Mm-hmm. No doubt at all. Mind you, there are other causes. Mm-hmm. To be fair, there's not only one. You see, the big decision made by Sir Robert Menzies, then Mr. Menzies, Prime Minister, to finance the universities of Australia after the Murray Commission, that was the decisive thing of all for all Australian universities. We got money at last, and there was expansion. And we felt by the 60s, those of us who remember back to the 45 period, affluent. And those young staff who came in the 60s had no idea what it was like 15 years before.
From where you stand now, outside the university and separated from it by a few years, do you think the university's role in the community now is better than it was in earlier times?
Unquestionably. Now, from 1945 when I joined the staff to 1954-55 when the Royal Commission, the Orr case came on, there was constant criticism that the university was divorced from the community.
And do you believe that true?
Well, that was true. Mm-hmm. That was true. And the not as much so as they said, but it was true. A number of us participated. Sir John Morris, again, used to try to get staff members to do things outside, to give lectures to the Adult Education Board and so on. And some did. But generally speaking, there was this town and gown differentiation. And at that time, the students appeared to the town only during the commemoration night and the night before when they ran riot, and the degree ceremony in those days was a riotous affair. It's become very, very, very dignified now, but in those days all hell used to be let loose as people went up for the degrees. And that was the only time when the town really got to know the students, and they had their rank on the day before. And usually the comments were completely and without question against the university. Well, now, after the Orr case and the development of the university, and particularly the movement down to Sunday Bay, the Hobart citizens and the Tasmanian generally took a pride in the university. And staff began also to mingle in the community, were prepared to do more. Now, if I quote my own example, I was appointed in 1956 chairman of the Adult Education Board. When Sir John Morris died, I was asked by Sir Robert Cosgrove and Mr. Fagan to take on the chair, which I did. And they were exhilarating years with Mr. K.G. Brooks, the director, between we, who had a great triumph finally in 59 when he brought Sir Edmund Hillary out. And we filled the packing, packed the City Hall. Then again, I was asked to chair a committee inside the Education Department that was looking into reorganizing the whole secondary school system of the state, which we have now, the District Comprehensive High Schools. It began with Taruna and Clarence and then went around the state. Well, now, from 1958 to about 1964-65, we used to meet regularly each month planning this great change.
This was a direct input from the university into the community via the application process.
That's right, that's right. And I was then asked to, on four occasions, three-year intervals, to sit in on parliamentary salaries tribunals, 1960, 63, 66, and so on. Now, all these things were just examples, which some of my colleagues shared, of getting into the community and letting the community see we were not living in an ivory tower. So I think altogether the university appears now, after all these years, in a much different light from what it did 25 years ago.
What about students of the university who graduated, went out into the into the wider world? What students can you think of who have, in your mind, epitomised the objects of the university education?
Well,
men who've made their mark.
Well, I can call quite a number, and it's a little invidious to pick them out, because on the spur of the moment you might forget somebody who feels hurt. But obviously, in a department of political science, which I set up in 1956, we were training people not only for teaching or library work or public service, but they went out into the business world and so on. And in the end, I got people who got into the National Parliament. I think Senator Ray was the first of my students to get in. Now I've got Neil Blewett in on the Labour side, representing a constituency in Adelaide. And of course there have been quite a number in the State House of Assembly, like Neil Blewett, Neil Batt, and now Mr. Laurie, and the young backbenchers, Mr. Field. And, now, in addition to that, I did train year by year, literally hundreds of students who came up from the public service, both Commonwealth and state, some of whom have gone, of course, on the mainland, but others who are now occupying fairly senior positions in the state public service. Now, this could be repeated, I think, with other departments who have done much the same thing, even in the science field.
You were telling me earlier that some of the distinguished former students of the university from the time before you became a member of staff, people like Frank Green, what other people did you know who were former graduates of the university?
Well, again, you...
Who'd made their marks?
You caught me a little on the op. I couldn't, you know, just straight out answer that question. In my time, of course, there have been some who have been really distinguished, although they're much younger than the ones you mentioned. I thought, for instance, of Peter Conrad, who was a Rhodes Scholar and who was in my department as well as the English department, and who won the University Prize, the Chancellor's Prize at Oxford, given by Harold Macmillan, and then was elected a Fellow of All Souls, an unthinkable thing, at the age of about 22. We had some very distinguished students gone through university. Now, there are others, of course, who are in our midst still, who are not my students, but who are products of this university. There was a time when this university had the InterVarsity Debating Society Prize, the best in the Commonwealth, and this was in the little times of the 30s, with Sir Peter Crisp and Roy Fagan and Stan Burberry, all of whom are well known.
So it certainly made its mark over the years.
Oh, indeed. Even the old university, which was, as I've said, somewhat remote from the community, has, through its students, made its mark. And, of course, there have been a number of students who have gone overseas to distinguished positions in academic life.
Professor Tansley, thank you.
It's a pleasure.